Each fortnight, this podcast takes you behind the scenes to discover the interesting backstory behind those who are making and have made a success of their careers. What motivates them and their challenges may well give you some ideas for your own career development. Our podcasts are proudly sponsored by ANZIF and their Careers in Insurance Initiative. Here's our host, Mark Silvera.
Welcome to Business Made Personal. I'm Mark Silvera. Nick Akers has over 30 years' experience dealing with construction, engineering and liability claims. He is a director and Tasmanian state manager, as well as an executive loss adjuster at Technical Assessing. They are Australia's largest national independent, locally owned loss adjuster. Nick is also the newly elected president of the Australian Institute of Chartered Loss Adjusters. Welcome to Business Made Personal, Nick.
Thank you very much, Mark. Nice to be here.
Hey, Nick, I'm speaking to you. You're in sunny Tasmania at the moment. Is that where you spent most of your life?
It's certainly where I spent all my formative years from the age of six onwards, because prior to the age of six, I was actually born in England and raised up to that age in England. But all my schooling and social education occurred here in Tasmania.
Yeah. So what prompted your folks to move to Tasmania, Nick?
I think they were looking for a better lifestyle for their children in particular. They had three children. They ultimately had four when one was born here. And England was a pretty bleak place back in the early 60s. And a friend of the family's was an oil tanker captain, and he said that he'd been into Hobart on a number of occasions and thought it was one of the most beautiful cities he'd ever visited. Mm. And we ended up moving and living in Hobart.
And you've never been tempted to move out of Hobart or Tasmania?
Oh, certainly, yes. I worked for some time as a jackaroo in South Australia. This is all prior to becoming a loss adjuster, and ultimately went to agricultural college, because by that stage my family had bought agricultural land holding in the central Midlands of Tasmania, and we were growing fine wool, cattle, crops. So I spent 2 or 3 years away in South Australia, then came back, and this was all in the years leading up to 1989, when interest rates went through the roof. We were paying up to 20%, I think, at one stage. And so the banks decided I should have a change of career. And so I left the farm. I had a very wealthy uncle who managed to buy into the farm in partnership with my father. I left the farm and started truck driving, delivering vegetables from the market garden into Hobart City, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was 6 or 8 months after that that I was fortunate to sail with a lawyer called Steve Knight. And Steve was quite heavily involved with the formation and of AELA. He introduced me to loss adjusting. He thought I would make a good loss adjuster. And that was in about 1990. Mm. And I eventually started working for a company called then Robbins MBS, which later became GAB Robbins and various name changes after that, as a trainee loss adjuster.
Right.
And that's how my loss adjusting career commenced.
Yeah, right. So, you know, you'd been basically, let's call it a farm boy for want of a better term, and all of a sudden you're now whacking on a suit and sitting in an office.
Absolutely. It was a big shock, a very big shock. I was very fortunate to have two senior trainers, loss adjusters, who were my mentors and managers, Bill McWhirter and Anne Katzmarek. I don't know if either of them are alive now, but they were wonderful, relaxed, friendly mentors who were very helpful in my formative years as a loss adjuster, particularly because I had no experience in insurance whatsoever, other than making the odd claim on the farm.
Yep.
So But I found I took to it quite well. I relished the challenge that loss adjusting presented, and I think I was quite good at it because, and I say that because one of the main competitors was a company called Freeman's, and they approached me about 12 months into my training and offered me a position with them.
Yeah.
So I ultimately left Robbins MBS and went to work for Freeman's in Hobart.
Yeah, yeah.
And Hobart was going through tough, well, Tasmania was going through tough times at that stage. There was the massacre at Port Arthur, and the economy was in a very poor state. And so I thought, well, the only way I'm going to get experience the much larger complex claims is to move interstate.
Right.
So I moved to Mackay in North Queensland and to another Freeman's office, which was based around the coal industry with all the coal fields inland and the tourism industry, the Great Barrier Reef out to sea.
Yeah.
So there's quite a dichotomy of different claims that we would be exposed to, from looking at mining claims through to getting a helicopter and flying out to Hamilton Island to looking at all the cyclone damage to the hotel, or looking at an island where diving equipment had been stolen when there was nothing to see anyway, and yet the insurers were quite happy to pay me to hop into a chopper and fly out to that island and do those sorts of things. That was AMP back in those days, by the way.
Yeah.
I always remember that one. So I stayed in Mackay and for a couple of years, and then the opportunity came for me to move to Brisbane with GAB Robbins. So I did.
Mm.
And I was put into the liability team in Eagle Street in Brisbane. And I was then exposed to some really large, complex and interesting liability claims, which took me over many parts of Queensland and into northern New South Wales. At that time, GAB Robbins were also having difficulties with their Sydney office liability team because they were short on loss adjusters. And so I started doing work at the Sydney office, and they found me accommodation and put me up in accommodation. And I was rotating between Brisbane and Sydney, looking at claims in both offices.
Yeah.
And that went on for a couple of years until I got sick of flying between two cities. And at that stage, I was single because my first marriage had broken down. And so I ultimately thought an opportunity came up in Tasmania to be state branch manager. And so I took that on, moved back to Tasmania as state manager. And things went along quite well for a number of years. I grew the business quite substantially from where it was its humble beginnings, and I was really enjoying it until GAB Robbins management had a change of approach, and that led me to thinking I don't really want to be a corporate loss adjuster or a corporate manager of a loss adjusting practice. I want to be a loss adjuster.
Yeah.
Or continue to be a loss adjuster. I then sought out other opportunities, and that took me to McLaren's and then later to Crawford's.
Mm.
As a consultant or a contract loss adjuster in Tasmania.
So that's one of the things, isn't it, about what we do. I mean, once you've gained your skill set, it's really quite transportable, isn't it, across pretty well any of the loss adjusting business?
Yeah, and very much so with corporate loss adjusting houses, because whilst they all make out that they're different in one way or another, and they are to some extent, but the principles of a corporate loss adjuster are very much the same, whichever business you're with.
Yeah, and you then, because you've had experience with some quite significant losses over your time, as loss adjusters do. But you and I, we met at the claims convention last year, and you were talking to me specifically about Antarctica.
Yes. And that's really came about following my move to technical assessing. I started up their office in Tasmania because they were quite a small firm at that stage. they didn't have any representation in Tasmania, and I had worked with a number of former GAB Robbins staff who had gone to work for technical assessing in Sydney and Melbourne. And so I started technical assessing in Tasmania with my wife, and the opportunity arose to start doing work for ComCover, which is the Commonwealth Government insurer, handling claims in Antarctica. And these were very interesting but complex, with very long tails, because they relate to oil fuel or diesel fuel spillages which occur on the base but have to be remediated using bioremediation, which when we first started doing these claims was looking at 7 to 10 years per claim event. We're now down to about 5 to 7 years per claim event.
Right.
And so whilst I'd started looking at those claims in 2009-10, the opportunity came up for me to travel to Casey Station, where the majority of the claims were, on Sir Douglas Mawson's centenary, the 1st of December 2011.
Wow.
100 years to the day that he travelled to Antarctica on what was quite a disastrous voyage or mission. So we left Hobart in the Aurora Australis, which is the main supply and research ship that the Australian Antarctic Division operated, with about 75 expeditioners, we were called, so people travelling to Antarctica to either stay down there or go down there and then stay for the summer only and come back on another resupply voyage. So some were staying down there all winter, others were only staying for a few months. Fortunately, I was only going down, I thought, for 4 weeks,
yep,
which was the turnaround time of the ship to go down, unload, provide all the necessary stores, collect those people coming back to Hobart on the Aurora Australis. In the end, it turned into 5 weeks, and I know that probably doesn't sound like a big deal, but when you're away on a ship on your own for 5 weeks, I just had a young daughter, only 12 months prior, and so I was missing my family very much. But the experience was so wonderful that I would never, ever have any doubts about doing it again if I had the opportunity. It was the most wonderful opportunity.
So talk me through, I mean, you know, we've all heard of oil spillages in water. We've heard of oil spillages on land. When you're looking at somewhere like Antarctica, which, you know, is a World Heritage area, what are the bits and pieces you didn't know you had to consider, or what were the differences between a, let's call it a standard spill, as opposed to those in Antarctica?
Okay. The reason for me going down to Antarctica, and I didn't have to go necessarily, but was to be able to develop an understanding of the logistical issues the Australian Antarctic Division face in supplying resources, human and equipment, to Antarctica and keeping them there for however long it takes to deal with a claim. Mm. So they were two fundamental issues that I think it would be very hard for someone to understand unless they'd actually been down there and seen it for themselves.
Yeah.
The cost implications, and that's probably more the role that I have, is to adjudicate the claim costs and review the claim costs each year as they're presented before they're submitted to ComCover, can always be looked at without necessarily going down there, but you would still question how on earth it costs $1,500 per day per man to be in Antarctica.
Mm.
That's just a human labour cost. And then you've got all the costs associated with the actual work that goes on down there. So to answer your question, I've probably gone around a fairly long way, is that the Casey Station in particular is the largest station, the largest of three stations, because Australia has 51% control of the Antarctic continent. So they have three stations, Casey being the largest. It is made up of a series of buildings interconnected by various resources. That the main one being, of course, is fuel, because the base needs to be able to continue to run generators, lighting, and so on, using diesel fuel, which is pumped ashore from the Aurora Australis each year. And I'm talking about 1 million litres we pumped ashore from the Aurora Australis to the main fuel depot. And then from the main fuel depot, that diesel fuel is pumped up to various parts of the base for their powerhouses, generator houses. And so it's the linking of all those parts is where the opportunity comes, though, for pipes to fracture in very extreme cold conditions.
Right.
And that's what we were dealing with is, and of course, these claims might not be found until 6-8 months later after the snow's melted.
Mm.
And so the necessity then is that they have to excavate up all the contaminated soil or rock and move that somewhere so it can be treated.
Right. Well, so you can't actually just take it to the tip, right? So
No.
So they have to move it away from the site and then it gets heat treated or what happens?
Yeah, okay. So the process is you excavate the contaminated material. It then goes to a treatment area where large pads have been constructed and the contaminated material is placed down along those pads and then covered with tarpaulins or plastic. Then at the right time, warm or hot air is pumped into those mounds. Fertilizer is added to encourage the natural development of the bacteria, which is naturally forming, by the way, down there. And that eats away very slowly the hydrocarbons, being the contaminated component of the material.
Yeah.
But because you only have effectively 2 to 2.5 months of the year to carry out this work, that's why it's such a slow process.
Yeah, okay, understood. So Nick, you know this thing's called Business Made Personal, right? So talk to me about getting to Antarctica, because they talk about the ride being quite a roller coaster getting over there. But more importantly, after that question, what's it like living in a place that is so isolated?
Answering the first part of your question, when I left on the voyage, I didn't really know what to expect. And I was given a buddy by AAD, Australian Antarctic Division, who was a very nice young man and we got on very well. But I soon became conscious that there was only so many movies I could watch in my room or elsewhere for all this time I was away on the ship. And as it happened, the galley crew were shorthanded. So I volunteered to work in the galley. So for the whole voyage, more or less, I became a de facto galley hand, doing everything from washing dishes to peeling potatoes and carrots and doing everything that was necessary to keep about 120 to 130 people fed with 3 meals a day. And I actually really enjoyed it.
Mm.
So the second part of your question, what's it like? Well, if you can imagine, once you hit the Southern Ocean, the seas are just enormous. I was taking half a Phenergan tablet a day, which was just enough to quell my seasickness. Consequence of that is that when you go to sleep, you sleep like a log. It really makes you sleep. But by the same token, as you're heading further south, there's less and less daylight, to the point to when you get to Antarctica, it's in the summertime, there is no darkness. It's perpetually daylight. But as far as the actual voyage itself goes, I got thrown out of my bunk once. I broke my little toe going from my bunk to the bathroom because it was so rough. But it was all part of the experience.
Yeah. Mate, I get sick in the bath, so I'm not going to try it. But talk to me. So you end up there for 5 weeks, and okay, there's 175 people, but there's also the people that were already there that were ready to ship out.
Yeah,
it's not a huge amount of people.
No,
you've got 5 weeks close confines where the weather's not exactly, you know, it's not, you're not in the Bahamas. How did all of that work for you mentally?
I guess I just found it the most incredible place to be. The scenery, and you might think, well, it's all either white or grey. Well, it is, but the shades and the colours and the vastness of where you are just changes your whole mindset. It's not like you're thinking, oh, I need to sit in front of a fire all day long. You want to be out there. You want to be experiencing these things. Yes, it was cold, but you just put an extra layer on.
Yeah.
I should probably clarify that I was only on the continent for 3 days and 2 nights.
Oh, right.
The rest of the time I was on the ship.
Oh, wow.
Because our accommodation is so of such short supply, because you have people who were on the base that were going to come off and people on the ship who were going to go onto the base. And so there was no spare accommodation. I was very fortunate to get 2 nights on the station.
Mm.
So I had to cram a lot in to those 3 days. And fortunately, I got to see quite a lot of what goes on. And the rest of the time I was on the ship. And that's why I'm saying I spent so much time in the galley, because you go somewhat stir crazy in the ship if you didn't have anything else. Because there was no internet access.
Mm.
I don't know what it's like now, but back then there was no internet access.
Mm. And so what, you know, most people never get to experience that sort of thing specifically for work, and certainly not in insurance, other than, you know, maybe putting the insurance program together in the first place. What did you, were there challenges in that environment that you didn't expect when you were heading over there?
Good question. I think I didn't know really what to expect, full stop. That's the thing, because everything seemed to go so well as the trip went on, other than the fact that I broke my toe or whatever else. Although I was working in the kitchen every day, the galley every day. But overall, I just found the whole thing quite exciting and interesting, and I met some really wonderful people. I'm talking about a chap who now is a geologist professor in Brisbane, on the Sunshine Coast, and he'd crossed the Arctic on sled, on foot, and he. It was just amazing stories that they made a film of it with, can't think which insurer it was that helped fund it. It was one of those worldwide expeditions. And, he was most fascinating. And he actually took me out to a glacier where he was looking at maybe changing the road access to the Casey Station from the actual port. When I say the port is just a very basic wharf, because the ship can't get right into the wharf itself. So everything has to come in either on barge or in boats.
Right.
And I'm talking about things from like a 20-ton excavator through to containers of food or whatever else it might be. So, again, these are really big logistical issues. And just looking at all that just continue to help formulate my ideas of how hard it is to supply, resource, operate, function in that environment.
Mm.
And I think that's really stood me in good stead dealing with their claims. I've been able to actually give them some really, I think, novel ideas of how they can change the way they look at their claims to improve the results that they're getting in Antarctica.
Okay. I'm fascinated by your mention of the geologist you met over there. I'd be interested to know, forgetting Antarctica for a moment, but just generally speaking, have there been other people that have been really influential in your life or your career?
I was thinking about that, and I think I'd have to say the founding director of technical assessing was a man called Steve Nance. And Steve opened me up to the Lloyd's London market. He supported me going there back in 2010, I think, my first, or two, yeah, 2010, I think, was my first trip to London. And it was his encouragement and support that ultimately led me to end up going to London every year thereafter to meet with the clients, because here in Australia, the local market doesn't necessarily provide you with the complex, interesting major losses. It's the Lloyd's underwriters, the Lloyd's brokers that are involved so much with the Australian insurance market that can provide you with the opportunities that the local market can't.
Yeah.
And that's what really helped pave the way forwards for me to become the loss adjuster I am today, and probably even the person I am today, as a result of Steve Nance's support.
Mm. And forgetting Antarctica for a moment, but what would you say has been the most interesting job that you've ever been on?
It's a really tough question, Mark.
It's like, which one of your children do you love the most?
Yeah. Look, the AAD stuff is very interesting, but it is repetitive. So I've been doing their work, as I said, since 2009, I think it is. So each year I just get all these spreadsheets of costs that I have to work through. That was great initially, and I still get some satisfaction from doing it. But since then, I guess doing some really interesting work in more remote places, Exmouth in West Australia, I had to go up there to look at a canal subdivision, which during its construction, the contractor went broke, a cyclone hit it, and many of the concrete retaining panels all started to rotate. And that was a English insurer, contract works insurer. And so the fact that another contractor had to be brought in to help try and rectify the damage with the original contractor going broke made all these things more complex. And being in such a remote place as Exmouth in West Australia was certainly a challenge. And I relished that challenge and relished the work.
Mm.
Again, in West Australia, there's a mine called Telfer Mine, which is a gold mine. And I was sent there to look at a raise borer claim. So this is a machine that drills a hole a kilometre deep, 5 foot diameter.
Mm.
So it drills down a pilot hole to the incline, the underground incline. Then they put on a 5 foot diameter bit at the end of the rods. And then that machine then draws in a circular motion that bit up through the ground to create a 5 foot diameter hole, a kilometer deep.
Mm.
That's for mine ventilation because it's so hot, 1 kilometer below ground. The dual string broke halfway. It was a pretty calamitous event when all that drill string fell back down the hole and just disintegrated once it hit the ground. You're dealing with very, very expensive mining equipment, and the costs were quite substantial. I ended up having to go to West Australia twice.
How did they get the bit out?
Well, what they had to do is all the bit had fallen down into the incline, so they then had to cut it up using a remote gas lance on a long pole because no one was allowed to get in that area. And so that was a very large cost as well in its own right, because it's not like you could just go up, grab something and remove it. It had all had to be done remotely, and I think they had almost like a robotic control system to go in, cut the pieces and then draw them out. So that was another interesting one.
Yeah.
But look, Mark, I'd have to say nearly every claim is interesting in its own right.
Yeah.
They all have their nuances. They all have their quirkiness. It doesn't matter if it's a $300,000 claim, a $3 million claim, or a $30 million claim. They're all really interesting in their own ways.
We're speaking with Nick Akers, who's the Director and Tasmanian State Manager and Executive Loss Adjuster at Technical Assessing. Nick, I'd like to change tack a little bit, and let's talk about, you know, you're a Tassie farm boy. You've basically travelled the world with your insurance career. If I was to say to you during your lifetime, whether it's personal or whether it's business, and I said to you, what's the most challenging time that you've had, what would you say it was?
I don't know about challenging time. I think the challenges I've had to face is juggling my work life and my family life.
Mm.
I don't know if that adequately answers the question that you're posing, but it is difficult at times because you are drawn at all times of the day, week, month to go to places which are invariably difficult to get to, costly to get to, and mean long times away from home. And when you have a young family, that puts a lot of pressure on your wife, in my case, and of course you miss your children. So I guess that would be one of the things I did struggle with at times.
How have you managed it?
By having a very patient and accepting wife.
It certainly helps.
It does. I must say, if I hark back to, you mentioned me being a farm boy, when I left the farm, I never ever imagined I would be doing what I now do or become what I am now.
Yeah.
But it was pretty challenging for me being this young man who thought his life was going to be a farmer for the rest of his life, growing up in the farm that we bought, to all of a sudden driving a truck, getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, delivering vegetables.
Mm.
And so maybe that spurred me on to doing something much more with my life. And in hindsight, my body would never have been able to keep up the farming or the gruels of farming as I grew older. It's hard enough now. But in all seriousness, I can't imagine a more interesting, rewarding and fascinating career as a loss adjuster. It's just, you know, the fact that I can travel the world like I've done, go to places all over Australia. I mean, some of the places I've been to, mine sites, construction sites, manufacturing sites, it's just amazing the things you see, and all goes to improving your intellect.
I remember having this conversation with Professor Alan Manning, and he said it is one of the few industries where you get to learn about other businesses at such a detailed level.
Yes, precisely. And Alan Manning was my first regional manager.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah. He was at Robbins MBS at that stage.
Very, very small world. So if I said to you, Nick, you could change one thing about the insurance industry, what would you want to change?
Well, it's funny because I did think about this question in that I think of the insurance industry in its own totality. I see it as being an industry of problem solving, as distinct from purely insurance. It's almost as if people say, well, you have to sort out the insurance claims. Well, we do, but we're not the ones that generate the policies. We're not the one that sells the policies. We're not the ones that deals with the premium collection and all that goes with it. Our role is solely to solve the problems that the insurance industry have created in their own ways, or the poor insured have, or third party have incurred as a result of activity of one shape or another. What would I like to see change? Oh, probably, I think anyone who enters the insurance workforce should have to undergo an insurance claim of their own and understand what it's like to have an insurance claim. I think, I don't know, that probably sounds a bit trite, but I think there's so many people just don't get that they're there to help the insured and try and find ways to pay a claim rather than find ways to avoid a claim. And that's probably a bit contentious, I know, but...
No. In fact, I was just going to say, it's interesting you say that because I recently interviewed Tim Rafton, who's the general manager of claims for IAG, and he actually had a motor car accident in which he lost both his legs, and he was saying that incident was the very spur that has made him much more understanding, if you like, of other people going through claims. So it doesn't sound trite at all. In fact, it sort of backs him up in terms of his view on how you become the sort of individual you are and he is, right? Nick, I've got a couple of final questions before I let you go. If you were able to go back to 13-year-old Nick Akers and you were able to give him some advice, what would you say to him?
Oh, wow. Go out and enjoy life because it is so short. I don't know if that's what you're looking for or what, because that's, I'm talking about holistically how short life is.
Yeah.
Your career is there for as long as you want to pursue it. But life in itself, I lost both parents within 7 months, 2 years ago. And I think that really then sets you up for the knowledge that you're next in line. And how can you improve the rest of life that you've got left to make the most of it?
I hear you. A final question for you, Nick Eckers. If you were to give some advice to someone entering the insurance industry, what advice would you give them?
I would love to see people grasp opportunities when they come along and have a go at doing all sorts of different things. I can't imagine someone in a clerical position or a claims position in the insurance industry coming to start and just staying doing the same thing day in, day out, month in, month on for years when there must be so many opportunities that become available in a business. And I think that's the only way you're going to truly understand whether that's where you want to, the industry that you want to be in, and how you can best pursue where you want to end up ultimately in a certain area of the industry.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, in your case, it's interesting. And you know, when I use the term farm boy, I don't use it derogatively.
No. I get that.
I actually use it with affection because I know that you've actually gone back to farming in some way, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. And that also came about by accident in that my mother-in-law purchased a small land holding here on the east coast of Tasmania, and with it came 460-odd olive trees across 2 hectares. And, of course, my wife and I were managing and operating that land holding because it was too much for her. Ultimately, she retired, and so we bought the property off her, and we still now continue to grow and produce olives and produce olive oil from those olives, which we've had some considerable success with. And I think it's also probably grounded me back to my roots of being on the land, and enjoying the experience that brings again, with being outdoors in a very peaceful setting without the calls of the telephone, because the telephone doesn't work there for a start, and obviously no emails, and without the need for people to be complaining or arguing with you about whatever it might be, other than just the birds that are singing in the nearby trees. So, sounds very utopian, I know, but it's a wonderful place to be when you want to escape.
Sounds ideal, mate. And rumour has it that it's not just, you know, you're not just creating olive oil. You actually won a medal at the Sydney show. Have I got that right?
Yes, that's right. In 2017, we won Grand Champion in the boutique division at Sydney show. And so, in fact, my wife and I were sitting at Melbourne Airport on the way to Italy, which was part of my trip to London, but we tacked on Italy amongst other countries. And we got the call from the Sydney Show Society to say, well, you need to be at our forthcoming presentation because we've got something to present to you. And we couldn't make it because we were overseas at the time, so my mother-in-law went in our place. But so that was a lovely accolade. We also, since then, we've generally only entered the oil in the Tasmanian show society here, and each year we've won a gold and a silver. We have 7 varieties, but generally in 2 of those varieties we've won at least a gold and a silver for our oil. So it's interesting times. It's just nice to have something else to I guess let your mind escape to.
It's that mental health thing
in the work we do.
It's that mental health balance, isn't it?
It is.
That you, well, that's work-life balance as well, right? Nick Akers, you are a man of many, many talents. Thank you so much for chatting with me on Business Made Personal.
Oh, thank you for asking me, and thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for lending us your ears. Please remember to click follow on your podcast app or subscribe at bmppodcast.com.au so we can give you a sneak peek of our next guest. Until next time, I'm Mark Silvera, and you've been listening to Business Made Personal.